This is All About Jack, a C.S. Lewis podcast, just one of the many resources available at EssentialCSLewis.com. EssentialCSLewis.com is a feature partner site on the Middle Earth Network. I'm William O'Flaherty, and if you're listening to this around the time I'm releasing this show, you might be expecting the third part of the Lewis and Women miniseries. I'm interrupting that with Easter around the corner to share an essay chat with Dr. Michael Ward that is indirectly related to the resurrection of Jesus. The Lewis and Women series will start back on April 28th because I will be sharing another conversation I had with Dr. Ward next week. However, if you want to listen or purchase the last two shows or the entire miniseries on Lewis and Women, you can visit my newly created Bandcamp page. Go to EssentialCSLewis.bandcamp.com to see the details. Again, that's EssentialCSLewis.bandcamp.com. You can also follow the links found in the show notes for this show. For today, I'm discussing Myth Became Fact with Dr. Ward, who will be one of the featured speakers at Taylor University for their 2014 colloquium at the end of May. I spoke with Dr. Pamela Jordan Long not long ago about it, and the show notes at EssentialCSLewis.com will give you a link to that interview and to their pages online to learn more about it. One final note, the audio quality of this program when it was done in 2012 ended up being much less than desired. However, I was able to make at least some minor improvements for this rebroadcast. As has been done in other shows like this, Dr. Ward and I will be dealing with just the single Lewis essay mentioned, which again is Myth Became Fact. Our hope is to spark your interest in reading it yourself for the first time, or to revisit it if it's one you've previously read. First on the agenda is the background to the essay. Myth Became Fact was first published in the September-October issue of World Dominion. Presently, the best place to get a copy of it is in the God in the Dock collection of Lewis essays. Something also important to remember when reading this article is at the beginning, Lewis mentions a person by name, that is someone he calls Corineus. Now, this is actually not a real person's name. That's probably a good place to kick off the discussion, Dr. Ward. Why do you think Lewis didn't name names here?
Well, maybe Corineus. I pronounce it Corineus. I don't know if Corineus or Corineus is the right way to pronounce it, but I don't think myself that Corineus represents, or Corineus, Corineus represents any particular person. I think he's representative of an opinion or an attitude to Christianity. But even if he is representative of some particular historical personage, there would be good reasons for Lewis not to mention him. You know, for instance, in Mere Christianity, Lewis doesn't mention Freud. He just talks about a famous psychoanalyst. And in his book on Experiment and Criticism, he doesn't mention F.R. Leavis. He just talks about the Vigilant School of Critics at Cambridge University. So it was often Lewis's tactic not to name names because he wanted to keep the focus of the discussion on the subject rather than on the people. He thought it would be unwise to personalize many of these discussions. It would tend to distract from actually discussing the merits of the case.
Well, now, before noting how the details of this relates directly to Lewis's conversion, let's get into why myth seems to be one of those, we might say, a four-letter word to so many Christians.
Yeah, well, often when people hear the word myth, what they understand is simply some untrue story, a piece of fiction. And that's, I think, why it's a four-letter word to some Christians. But in addition to having that meaning, it has another meaning, which is a more technical meaning, an imagined story, which communicates truth. I mean, in a way, I suppose one could talk about the parables of Jesus as myths in this sense, that they, you know, the story of the Good Samaritan, the story of the prodigal son, and so on, they are pieces of fiction which are nonetheless designed to communicate spiritual truth. And it's that meaning that Lewis tends to deploy when he's talking about myth.
Well, now, how then does this relate to Lewis's conversion?
Yes, Lewis was converted to Christianity in large part through a very significant conversation he had one night in Magdalen College, Oxford, with his friends J.R.R. Tolkien and Hugo Dyson. These two men came to dinner with Lewis, and they walked around the grounds of the college and discussed metaphor and myth and Christianity. And it was in large part as a result of that conversation that Lewis became a Christian shortly thereafter. He described the conversation as the immediate human cause of his coming to faith in Christ. And what the conversation had been about, really, was the similarities that there are in many respects between the Christian Gospels and certain myths of dying and rising gods in pagan mythology. And what Lewis was saying at this point, he was still not a believer. He was saying that he found pagan myths of dying and rising gods. He mentions Balder and Adonis and Bacchus. He found those stories profound and suggestive of meanings beyond his grasp. He couldn't say in cold prose exactly what they meant, but he thought that they were very suggestive and very meaningful. But when he considered the story of Jesus Christ, this dying and rising God, he was left rather uninvolved, because he tended to approach Christianity more as a set of doctrines rather than as a narrative. And what Tolkien and Dyson showed Lewis was that the doctrines are not the main thing about Christianity. The doctrines are kind of translation into our concepts and ideas of that which God has already expressed in a language more adequate. I'm quoting here from a letter Lewis wrote about this conversation. So the doctrines are secondary, they're translations. And what is the primary language is the lived language, the actual historical language of a real man, namely Jesus of Nazareth, being born in a real place and dying and rising again in Palestine in about the year AD 33. That's the lived language. That's the language more adequate. And that's what Christianity is really about. Whereas doctrines of justification, sanctification, propitiation, and so on, those doctrines are secondary. And they aren't what have to be believed in the primary sense. They are dependent upon the story of Christ's incarnation, crucifixion, and resurrection. And it's that which comes first. So when Lewis was convinced of this fact by Tolkien and Dyson, that Christianity was primarily a historical narrative rather than a set of abstract theological propositions, then he began to see how he could find meaning and power and suggestiveness in the Christian story, because he could approach it with his imagination as well as his intellect. And that was a huge breakthrough for Lewis. A few days after this conversation, he had this life-changing trip to Whipsnade Zoo, and he said that when he set out for the zoo, he did not believe that Jesus Christ is the Son of God, but when he reached the zoo, he did. And it was in large part the effect of that conversation.
Well, now, in the essay directly, Lewis cites several examples about concrete experiences that one can't really experience if they are only thinking or analyzing them. What are your thoughts about this part of the essay?
Yes, he talks about, for instance, laughter. You can't study laughter while you're roaring at a joke. You can't study pleasure in the moment of an embrace with your wife. He says, if only my toothache would stop, I could write another chapter about pain, but once it stops, what do I know about pain? So there's always this distinction in Lewis's mind between the enjoyment of a thing and the contemplation of a thing. Contemplation and enjoyment, or looking at and looking along, this was a really important distinction in Lewis's mind. He describes it as an indispensable tool of thought, this distinction. And he's prepared to divide consciousness itself into these two modes, the mode of enjoyment and the mode of conscious contemplation. So when it comes to myth, the relevance of this distinction is that Well, it goes back somewhat to what I was just saying about the difference between the narrative story in the Gospels and the doctrinal comment upon those Gospels in theological formulation. The actual lived story of Christ's life, death, and resurrection is, if you like, the enjoyment account, and the doctrinal formulations that come afterwards that you find in the epistles of St. Paul and the other New Testament writers, those are, as it were, contemplations upon that story. They are abstract accounts of it. They are thoughts and reflections upon it, but they are not the thing itself. And obviously, you need to get things in the right order. You need to put first things first, and there would be nothing to reflect on or think about unless there had originally been the story, the lived, actual, historical story of Christ's life, death, and resurrection. So myths, as far as Lewis is concerned, are stories in which the meaningfulness is bound up with the very events themselves. There's a distinction to be drawn between myths and allegories. In an allegory, you need another set of terms in which to understand the story. But in a myth, the story is understandable in its own terms. You can feed on the story and immerse yourself in the story, and that's the best thing to do with it. And really, that's what Lewis is talking about when he refers to Christianity as a true myth. The best thing to do with it is continually to feed upon the fact of Christ's life, death, and resurrection, rather than feeding upon the doctrinal formulations that come after the event. Which isn't to say, of course, that the doctrines aren't important. Of course they're important, but they're secondary.
Well, now, even though this is a somewhat short essay, I've got an audio version that's about, I think 12 minutes. There are some other aspects we could explore, but of course we want the listener to read the essay firsthand. But as we close out this segment, are there any other points that you would like to emphasize that's important in this essay?
Well, one interesting thing in the essay is that Lewis talks about Christianity as a myth become fact. That myth becomes fact in the same way that God becomes man. God becomes man without ceasing to be God. And in the same way, myth becomes fact without ceasing to be myth. And the point of that is that myth will take us beyond time and space. That's the point. That the historical fact of Jesus' crucifixion and resurrection is not just another historical fact exactly parallel with, say, you know, the facts about George Washington or Napoleon or Winston Churchill. Of course, it is a historical fact, but it's more than a historical fact, because it connects space and time with eternity and infinity, just as Jesus Christ is both a historical human figure and the Son of God. And so that's what Lewis means when he's talking about Christianity's myth become fact. And that's a very important clarification, I think, to enter at this point.
Are there other essays that, you know, people would find related to this particular essay?
Yes, there's a very important piece called Is Theology Poetry, which is relevant to this. Lewis touches upon many of the same themes in that piece, Is Theology Poetry? His book Miracles also touches upon this a fair bit, as does one of his earliest works, Pilgrim's Regress. It's really a very important subject for Lewis all over his non-fiction and apologetic work. And of course, indirectly, it informs so much of his own fiction, because, you know, Lewis's own love of writing stories is in large part derived from the huge value that he attached to this concept of Christianity as a story.
Well, before we go, let's share a couple quotes that especially stood out. I've got a couple. One was, myth is the isthmus which connects the peninsula world of thought with that vast continent we really belong to. And then another one, slightly longer, it says, we must not be ashamed of the mythical radiance resting on our theology. We must not be nervous about parallels and pagan Christ. They ought to be there. It would be a stumbling block if they weren't.
Well, I always like the very last sentence where he says, this is the marriage of heaven and earth, perfect myth and perfect fact, claiming not only our love and our obedience, but also our wonder and delight, addressed to the savage, the child, and the poet in each one of us, no less than to the moralist, the scholar, and the philosopher.
Well, that's probably just as good as a way to wrap up our chat here. Again, with the Lewis essay, Myth Became Fact. It's available primarily, or the best source still in print would be the essay collection, God in the Dock. Be sure and check out the show notes for a link for that, as well as a link to Dr. Michael Ward's website about the Narnia Code. Thanks, Michael, for being with me today.
Thanks very much, William. Good to speak with you. Thank you.